to order. Welcome, everybody. The first bill that we have down for public hearing, we did hear on Friday. And so I think I'm not going to hear. But we have people who want to testify, so I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2269. And Judith, you want to remind us what this bill is?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2269 is the measure that increases fees for issuance of motor vehicle registration plates. This would change the actual cost to directing the department to set that cost as the cost of manufacturing the plates rounded up to the highest half dollar, and then adding a dollar for a single plate and $2 for each pair of plates. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have three people signed up, and the first person on the list is Richard L. Koenig.
Koenig. Thank you. Would you like 20 copies?
Would you hand them to staff? Thank you. Make sure you identify yourself and your residence.
My name is Richard L. for my mother's maiden name, Koenig. I'm from Portland. I'm with the Committee for Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Laws. I can refer you to my written testimony, but I want to make sure that we're on the same page, so I'm going to diverge from that orally. As Rip Gilman is aware, from having been given notice by the ODOT last year, last session, now that ODOT has adopted their optional titling rule that permits the agency to accept money from the public, if the public still wants to support the DMV program, it's quite likely that there will not be the same level of participation in the DMV program as we've historically had. So any consideration of bills that are related to revenue for ODOT should take that into account, and because we're going to be looking for not new particularly, but we're going to be looking for enhanced revenue streams to replace the revenue from the public who may not decide to continue to support the DMV program. So on this particular bill, you've got the surcharge, the dollar for single plate and the two for two. I would say that that should be kept open, or maybe jacked up 300-500% right off the bat to offset the losses that we can reasonably anticipate. But in my recommendations here, what I have proposed as definitive is that before we go too much further down the road, that we do some polling of the public to see what kind of support there will be for the DMV among the people that are now allowed to title their vehicles if they want to, because how are we going to otherwise know? So I propose that you insert, that you amend the bill to include some kind of polling mechanism to see how many members of the general public are going to want to continue to pay the fees for titling, registration, plates, driver license, all that stuff that they have been used to doing. Now that they've gotten notice, who knows, we may be looking for a lot of money. I've also included with your handout there the information that Mr. Gilman got from ODOT, the Statement of Need and Fiscal Impact. Turn your attention. I think I've highlighted almost every copy. You see all have highlighted lines there? That's the people who are described as going to be financially impacted if they choose to title their vehicles. And under the current law, it says when a member of the general public or when an owner chooses to title his vehicle, it becomes subject to all of the provisions of the vehicle code. And if they don't choose, well, we can all figure that out. That's concludes my testimony. Do you have any questions for me? I've been researching this and associating myself with the DMV for about 11 years since the Attorney General told me about the nature of the commercial nature of the vehicle laws. So I know a little bit about it.
Thank you.
Yes,
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question to staff. The circumstances under which optional titling of vehicles, this isn't the car that you and I drive to work in the morning and then we change it. This must have some very, very selective circumstances.
I'd like to speak to that. In the language of Mr. Mumau's bill proposal, what he did say, Mr. Mumau being the former director of the DMV, what he did say that historically he'd been illegally titling and registering people's vehicles. And what he was meaning is the vehicles that are not required to be titled. And if you check out the current statutory language, y'all got notes there, no paper, but at ORS 803.030.14C, it explicitly describes the vehicles that must comply with the titling requirement, and it's the same language almost exactly for the registration requirement at 803.305.14C. Those are the vehicles, and I'm going to quote that statute, vehicles operated over the highways of this state for compensation or profit must comply. Now, if you go to the definition section of the vehicle code, what it says there is commercial vehicles, and it describes for compensation or profit, naturally. And then if you go to the section immediately preceding that, it says commercial motor vehicles. Slightly different, but it breaks out commercial vehicles into subcategories. And in subsection 2 of 801.208, it says that the following vehicles are not included in the vehicles that must be titled. And those include non-business purpose vehicles and solely for personal use vehicles. And I'll give you the exact reference to that if you want. It's 801.208, sub 2, sub, I believe it's C and sub E are the two that talk about, thank you, excellent.
What is it again?
I believe it's C and E. Okay. Talks about the non-business purpose, 801.208. And if you look at the committee minutes in regard to the Senate Bill 124 of 1985, it's very explicit. The lady who came over and talked for the director of the DMV, her name was Joanne Peterson, she very explicitly stated that it's not what a vehicle looks like, but the use to which the vehicle is put that determines whether it will be titled and registered. And that's reflected in the language there at 801.208, sub 2. Do you see that language there?
Yeah.
See the one where it talks about the vehicles, the non-business purpose vehicles? I think it's under motorhomes or the non-business purpose. And recreational vehicles, it's another one, the solely for personal use vehicles. And then if you hold that up.
We're going to go ahead and...
I just want to make sure that...
Yeah, we're going to come back to this, and we'll bring ODOT up and have them...
Wonderful. I would love to spend some time with my friends from ODOT to help y'all get up to speed on this. But Mr. Gilman was in correspondence with them last year. Brenda Trump sent you over that package, did she not?
Yes.
On the optional titling, the adoption of that? Well, I have a certificate of service that says that the chairs and the co-chairs got notified.
Okay. Thank you.
All right,
and
thank you.
I think we're, when I said we'd have ODOT come up, I probably misspoke. We do want a response from ODOT, but I'm not sure they're going to be ready today to give it to us, and we're not going to be acting on the bill anyway, so we will get a response.
3-4 days notice, I can make it back.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I perhaps don't have as much experience looking through these as I should. I guess it'd be beneficial just to have a listing of all the statutes that are being considered, because I'm not quite sure I see what I should be seeing or what I'm being told.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Was there testimony as to, and I stampede to apologize that I had to be in district last Friday, but was there testimony indicating how much the estimated actual cost, and I'd never propose that the department lose money on any of these kinds of activities, but was there testimony to say how much the rates would be with the 50 cent gross up?
Yes, Representative Butler, there was, and Jack is here and would be willing to address for you.
Just for the record, if that testimony was given, then that's all I need to know. I can follow up from there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, it was. Thank you. Okay, the next person on the sheet is Peter Rideout.
My name is Peter Rideout. I live in Northeast Portland. I'm here to offer my support to HB 2269.
Thank you.
With some recommendations for an amendment to update the David Mumau's 1985 optional titling program. As a member of the Committee for the Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Laws, I'm recommending amendment to its language to wit, each DMV officer and employee, prior to issuing a registration plate, shall inquire as to the person's employer and whether the person is employed principally to drive or to transport persons or property for compensation. When it is ascertained that it is a public member who is applying for the registration plate, the DMV shall inform the public member of the option to title and register their vehicle, which is not subject to the titling and registration requirements. Prior to accepting any fees from a member of the general public, a DMV officer or employee shall execute a certificate under penalty of perjury, which states that the officer or employee has made an adequate effort to fully inform the member of the general public of the commercial nature of the vehicle code. I'm not an expert on the vehicle laws, but I do know what they are about and would be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you.
No questions?
Any questions? I guess not. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Next one is Benjamin Philo.
Philo.
Thank you.
I thank you for your patience this day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ben Philo, and the two people you just heard speak about this issue are raising an issue that most of us are not aware of. I wasn't aware of it until about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I'll just begin by basically reciting what I have here in front of me. My name is Benjamin Philo, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I became a member of the Committee for Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Laws after being exposed to public records which reveal that our state laws actually don't support or authorize the compulsory titling and registration of the public's personal vehicles. The committee is a citizen-based public interest group which has assembled peacefully to educate the public about this important matter. Consider some selected words from a document, again, from Exhibit B in support of Senate Bill 124, 1985, drafted by the DMV Director, David P. Mumau. Historically, and I quote, historically, the division has titled vehicles at the request of the owner. Whether or not the vehicle was required to be registered, or whether the owners chose to register the vehicle, the authority to issue these documents does not exist in current law. The last line of the next paragraph after that says this, quote, if this authority were not continued, there would be some loss of revenue, unquote. The Joint Subcommittee responded to this Senate bill by enacting the optional titling and optional registration statutes at ORS 803-305 and ORS 803-040, respectively. As indicated by the statement of need and fiscal impact associated with the rule, which is there in parentheses, OAR 735-022-0120, intended to implement these statutes. The only people affected by this legislation are members of the public who, quote, choose to apply, unquote, for title and registration. It becomes clear that our state's motor vehicle code is only intended to be applied to commercial use vehicles and their commercial and their commercial or public service operators. When its language is weighed with constitutional and legislative construction limitations, please consider this Oregon Supreme Court case ruling from 1916, which is still current. Quote, the right of a person to drive a team hitched to a carriage or to control a vehicle upon a traveled street or to haul by ordinary means his own goods thereon without let or hindrance is common to all citizens who have occasion to use the highway for pleasure, profit, or advantage. When, however, a person engages in the transportation of passengers or freight or both for hire, he is pursuing a special business. And in order legally to exercise that privilege, the municipality may require of him the payment of a license fee. So, too, a city might by ordinance grant a person, firm, or corporation the right to transact any business which, without such permission, might be regarded in the nature of a nuisance. This is Kurtz versus Southern Pacific Company, 80 OR 218. I am supportive of HB 2269 in that its accommodations for future market value costs of producing registration plates do not technically affect public members like me. They affect the subject matter class of operators and vehicles found in ORS 803-590. To be fair, I expect that some of my honorable representatives may not be aware of the intended subject class of the motor vehicle laws, just as I was not. Most of us are not. The committee's goal is to educate our communities about this matter. I strongly urge the addition of language that indicates the law's actual intent, including provisions which require DMV personnel to fully disclose the commercial nature of the motor vehicle laws and notify public members that their participation is optional. One statute I'd also like to raise to your attention is ORS 336.057. This statute makes mandatory curriculum in our public schools that all schools from the 8th grade on through the graduation of college have to have a class dedicated to studying the Constitution. This is currently not enforced, as my experience tells me when I was in school. This would probably go a long ways towards improving our understanding about rights and our familiarity with where they apply. I thank you for your indulgence again. If you have any questions, please feel free.
Thank you.
I just had one question for Ben. Ben, the Committee for Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Law, is it that committee's opinion that citizens have no need to apply for a title or registration unless you are using it for commercial purposes?
It's actually not opinion, sir. It's supported in the law,
okay.
As this court case also
okay.
backs up.
Thank you very much. That's
thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
seeing no more questions, I am. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you. Okay. Buried it here. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2268. And Judith will explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2268 exempts school bus manufacturers, dealers, and mechanics who operate school buses that are not transporting students from school bus endorsement requirements. The measure also increases the minimum civil penalty for a violation of an out-of-service order such as if a truck is given such an order when it's stopped at a weigh station, an inspector finds some mechanical reason why it's unsafe for it to be on the road. So it increases the civil penalty for violating keeping that truck off the roads from not less than $100. It increases that minimum to $1,100 and increases the maximum civil penalty from not more than $2,000 to not more than $2,750, and that is for the commercial vehicle operator. Similar civil penalties are increased for the operator of the employer of the operator, those being establishing a minimum civil penalty of not less than $2,750 and increases the maximum from $10,000 to $11,000. Again, that's to the employer of the person of the commercial operator if that employer knowingly allows the operator to violate that out-of-service order. House Bill 2268 also eliminates the exemption for holders of farm endorsements from commercial driver's license disqualifications. In other words, they could be disqualified under certain circumstances, even if they're operating as a farm under farm endorsement. It does clarify that farm endorsements do allow the operation of tankers and double trailer combinations. The measure also establishes that a holder of a commercial driver's license commits a serious violation if he's found to be recklessly driving, he's operating a vehicle more than 30 miles over the posted limit, and the court agrees by imposing a suspension, or in fact the operator of the vehicle is driving the vehicle at a speed of 100 miles per hour or greater. This is considered now a serious, it would be considered a serious violation at that point. Two more things. The measure allows a person receiving a lifetime suspension from their commercial driver's license to apply for a right to reapply after 10 years from the date of the suspension. And finally, it does define what it means to hold a commercial driver's license. That is, a person either has a valid license, it's expired less than 1 year, or has been suspended but not canceled or revoked. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. The first person to testify is Jack Evans.
There we go.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I'm here today to talk in support of our bill, House Bill 2268, which is a cleanup measure that will bring us into compliance with federal regulations. This was begun last session. A great deal of work was done at that time getting us into compliance with federal regulations. Since then, we've had subsequent guidance from the federal government, and this bill has some additional changes that we'd like to make to get into compliance, as well as a couple of changes that we're making just to make some clarifications and to get rid of some ambiguity. So what I'll do is I'll just walk through these points. The first change deals with the school bus, driving a school bus. Last session, it was the law was changed to specify that anyone operating a school bus had to have a CDL and a bus endorsement. Since that time, we've had guidance from the federal government that says if you're a dealer, a manufacturer, or a mechanic, and you're operating an empty school bus, you don't need to have that bus endorsement. So that change has been made to statute, or would be made to statute by this bill. The second deals with an area of prohibiting courts from issuing a diversion for individuals that hold CDLs. If a person holds a CDL, they're held to a higher standard. If they get a DUI they're not allowed to have a diversion, which would allow them to not have it on their record. And that was passed last session. Since that time, there has been some need to clarify, well, what do you mean by to hold a CDL? And this is the federal definition that we're adding here. It means that it's valid and that it if it's expired, it hasn't been expired for more than a year, or it's suspended as opposed to being revoked. So there's a chance of that license that's in suspense being regained by the individual.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I just ask a clarifying
yes.
question? Thank you. That's confusing to me. So if it has expired, it's still considered valid?
That's correct. And here's the situation, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, here's where that might apply. An individual with a CDL has a DUI, and they're before the court, and the court is looking at it to see that, if they have a CDL at this time, then they're not eligible for a diversion. And that they could say, well, your medical certificate has been expired for less than a year, so you really don't have a CDL. Well, that's not true. The federal government is saying that you can't grant these, the courts cannot grant these diversions to holders of CDLs because they have these higher standards they're being held to.
Okay.
So hence this is the definition that we're using.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yes. Can a person voluntarily return the CDL and then they wouldn't have a valid CDL at that point? Once it's been used, then it's canceled and it's no further value, or does it still have value after it? If someone has a need for a CDL and then no longer has that need and has returned the CDL, it's not valid, or it still could be valid but held by the department, it still wouldn't have been expired. Is that still holding a valid CDL?
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, that's an interesting question. I don't think they envision that this is a way to evade if you have a DUI, to abandon your CDL and then get a diversion. But I will check out to make sure that my understanding is that it's valid, meaning it's current, which could mean it's in suspense, or that it and that it hasn't been revoked. But I don't think it addresses your voluntary ability to abandon the CDL in order to get a hold of a diversion. But I'll check that out for you.
Yes,
thank you, follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the acronym FMCSA?
Federal, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration.
And so this, Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. This just brings us into compliance with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration interpretation of, and they must have some guidelines with regard to someone who has applied for a CDL, hasn't yet received it, but it may have been issued 2 days ago, and then is subsequently picked up possession, a DUI, a DUI of some sort. So I'm assuming there must be some federal guidelines with regard to that as well.
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, we'll certainly find out for that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Quick question.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. If I may follow up on Representative Butler's question, and I apologize, I don't have the bill in front of me, so I'm just asking a clarifying question based on his thoughts. So a driver with a CDL who commits a DUI while driving their own vehicle is held to that higher standard.
That's correct. Representative Byer, Representative Smith, that's correct.
Thank you. Just one last follow-up
question.
And I want to, again, follow up on the first question of Representative Butler. If a citizen has a CDL, drives truck, no longer drives truck, but doesn't have that designation taken off their license, and 3-4 years later they're pulled over for a DUI, they're still then held? Well, I guess the license would have expired. You'd have to renew it. But if within that period of renewal time that they're not driving, they're still held to that highest standard.
Representative Beyer, or Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, that's correct. So if that is not an expired, if that license has not been has not expired for more than a year, that's considered to hold a CDL, and that would apply. If it has expired more than a year, then they would not have technically have a CDL, and it would not apply.
And just one last question.
Yes.
And I apologize.
That's fine.
I just want to learn here. And this action brings us then into compliance with federal regulation.
Chair by Representative Smith, that's correct. And this was clarified last session in 2005. What we're doing with this bill is just defining exactly what it means to hold a CDL so that we'll give Oregon courts guidance and they'll be consistent in their application.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. When we passed that 2 years ago, the reconnect the Fed rules. This is the one aspect of it that I did not like and I still don't like. I think the diversion program is an effective program and we're telling truckers that they can't use it. Just commentary.
Thank you.
If I may, just a question for staff. Is the CDL renewed annually or is it like my driver's license? Every 4 years or something like that.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I believe it is renewed every 2 years, but I better double check that.
So, Madam Chair, if I may, then a person who received their license on January 1st of 2006 subsequently has a stroke in June of 2006. Then is able to drive by January of 2007 on January 1st, has one drink too many, but is totally unable, cannot pass the physical so that they could drive any commercial vehicle, has no intention of returning to, then they are then precluded from that point forward, at least for another year, of ever being part of a diversion program, even though they are no longer a commercial drive. That's why I asked about the ability to return a CDL and actually having it canceled, because if you're held to a higher standard, I mean, if I'm going to be part of the legislature, then I'm going to be held to that higher standard, and I can't take a meal with somebody. But the day that I want to leave the legislature and I can go have a meal with someone, then I shouldn't be held to that same standard.
But I
don't know how you turn that ticket in without.
I don't know. We will not act on this bill today. We'll make sure all these questions are clarified. But I think we're going to still be in this a little of the same place we were when we had to pass the bill last time. As you know, we have to comply or we lose federal funds. And so.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. That's actually a lead into the question I have. Not now, but can you be prepared to come back to the committee and explain what is the fiscal consequence of noncompliance?
It's in here.
What is it in there?
Chair by Representative Smith. Yeah, in the second paragraph of the background there, we talk about the worst case scenario that if you were not in compliance, you could be. You could lose approximately $2.7 million annually in motor carrier safety assistance program funds, and $1.6 million of that goes to the police. There's also annual federal aid highway funds that could be withheld. So these would be the worst-case situation, but that's an exposure that causes us to take these issues pretty seriously.
Thank you.
And Jack, are all 49 other states in absolute full compliance, so far as you know?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, as far as I know, the expectation is that they be in compliance, but whether they are at this time, I'll find that out.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, and shall I move on to
yes.
The third one? The third one deals with an out-of-service order, and this is if you receive an inspection of your vehicle by ODOT, and it's determined that there's a mechanical problem. They don't want you out on the road until it's repaired, and you decide to drive off anyway. Again, this was something that there are civil penalties for. A person that or an employer that drives off without repairing these mechanical deficiencies are subject to civil penalties. And we discovered after the session last time that our civil penalties are slightly out of sync with those of the federal government. So what this does is just syncs them up with those ranges that are in the federal rules. Number four deals with the farm endorsement issue. And this is an exemption that currently farmers or drivers of farm vehicles have. And in the area of DUI, again, commercial drivers are held to a higher standard, the blood alcohol level, rather than being 0.08, which it is for passenger vehicles, is 0.04 for commercial vehicles. Farmers are currently exempt from this. The federal government has given us guidance that this is intended to apply to all individuals driving these commercial vehicles, commercial motor vehicles, regardless of who they are. Heavier vehicle, they're held to a higher standard, and this would remove the exemption and apply the sanctions across all commercial motor vehicles.
Madam Chair, does the federal government require this?
Chair Byer, Representative Gilman, that's correct. And this is something that
I'd like to have you show me in their rules where that occurs.
Chair Byer, Representative Gilman, I'll do that.
Thank you.
So just, Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. So if a farmer, even though they may not have the CDL, they are operating farm equipment, with a blood alcohol of 0.04, then that farmer then also loses the opportunity of diversion with regard to a DUI.
Chair by Representative Butler, that's correct.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
That's with regard to operating a farm truck with a farm endorsement. That doesn't apply to anything else other than a licensed truck.
Chair by Representative Butler, that's correct. If that individual were driving their private car and was stopped for DUI and had a 0.08, then that would have an impact on them. But in driving a commercial vehicle, it's 0.04.
If I can just follow up, so I'm a farmer driving my own personal automobile, and I blow a 0.06. What's the effect of that?
It's my chair by Representative Butler. Then you're okay, and then until you hit 0.08 driving a private vehicle. So if I may continue, if you were to be driving a heavier commercial vehicle, you'd be held to that higher standard. Driving your own passenger car, you're held to the same standard as everyone else.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, the next one deals with the definition of serious violations. There are violations in statute that impact CDLs, and this time around we're required to add a couple of new ones that were added last session, and these are added because they're violations for which an individual can be suspended, and those are someone that drives more than 30 miles an hour over the speed limit or drives at a speed in excess of 100 miles an hour. So those two are added to the serious violation statutes that can impact a CDL. The next one deals with a simple clarification, and this is to clarify that someone that has a Class A farm endorsement can also operate a tank vehicle or a double trailer combination. And this is the current ODOT interpretation, and we wanted to add it into the statute just to make it clear. Another clarification deals with the term trailer endorsement, and this is a label clarification. Right now, using the term trailer endorsement, this refers to double and triple trailers. If you have a Class A CDL, you're operating a vehicle that has a single trailer, by definition, you're fine. If you wanted to operate something with a double or triple trailer, you'd have to get this endorsement. So just to make that clear, the label is being changed to double, triple trailer endorsement. And the final one deals with the reinstatement of a lifetime suspension of a CDL after 10 years. Last session, the legislature synced up Oregon law with federal law and allowed a lifetime suspension of a CDL for a major offense after a period of 10 years of without any problems, an individual can get their CDL back. And this change was made last time to the statutes dealing with suspension, but it was left out of the reinstatement statutes. So this makes that correction. So those are the changes that we're envisioning that we'll need to make, and we look forward to your support.
Thank you. Any more questions? Okay, a question to the committee. Do you want ODOT to get back to you individually or bring them back before the committee?
Madam Chair, there's been a specific question asked of Mr. Evans by a committee member. I think it would be appropriate for Mr. Evans to get back to you as the chair and then have your assistant or the committee assistant get that information back to
each
one of us.
We'll do that. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2268. And open the public hearing on House Bill 2274.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2274 eliminates the sunset on the law that doubles fines for traffic offenses committed in safety corridors. Currently, those provisions are sunset on January.
I'm sorry. I'm going to close this public hearing on 2274, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2268, and I forgot to call someone forward, so state your name. Mea culpa here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Trucking Association, and I'm here to testify in support of most of the provisions of House Bill 2268. The provisions that I can't support are those that I don't know about. But as far as those that apply to heavy trucks, we're absolutely implementing the federal requirements. We've got to do it. It's really not an issue. Most of the stuff was in the Safety Act that was passed by Congress in 1999. Oregon was one of the last states to implement in 2005. And then DMV underwent an audit by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and these are some areas that the feds said that they needed to fix. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing. Is one of the questions that you had, Representative Butler, was could a person turn in their CDL and get a Class C license, and then what happened if you got a DUI? If they turn in their CDL and they are reissued a license, which is a regular operator's permit, then at that time they fall under the operator's permit rules and they're eligible for diversion. If they hold a CDL, they are not eligible for diversion. One of the major pieces of the federal law was that you couldn't do what's called masking, which is basically the diversion, and it takes away that violation after a period of time. So CDL holders are held to a higher standard. From my member's point of view, it's absolutely appropriate. We don't want people that are driving while they're intoxicated on the highways. That's our front office. So we support the changes in regulations.
Any questions?
Did I help?
Thank you. And now I'm going to close the public hearing on 2268 and reopen the public hearing on 2274. And Judith has explained, or have you?
Yeah. Pretty much.
Pretty much?
Eliminates the sunset that was going to happen on January 1st, 2008, that... regarding the provisions that currently double the fines for traffic offenses committed in safety corridors. So with that sunset date, this measure would become effective December 31st, 2007. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Troy Castellas.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Castellas. I'm the manager of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Before you is House Bill 2274, as Ms. Collins had identified, relating to safety corridors. ODOT established the safety corridor program in part due to legislative interest, and in 1999 was granted the authorization to test using double fine provision in two specific corridors to see if that would heighten the awareness and understanding of better driving behavior and safety corridors. Then in the 2001 legislature extended the pilot test and then allowed us to identify more than just the two safety corridors where we could place the double fine signs. The safety corridor program works, gets public attention. The double fine provision is something that the law enforcement uses as well as the community uses to gain awareness. And during public opinion poll, we checked with the public to see, are they understanding the definition of a safety corridor and the fact that they need to behave in that area? It's an area of concern. And the poll came back indicating the general public understood what a safety corridor was. In fact, safety corridor programs have worked so well, we've actually decommissioned five that were identified as safety corridor. We put the improvements in, the driver behavior changed, there's some roadway changes made, and the signs are gone. And they've stayed down at lower crash rates, injury rates, fatal rates than what they had previously. And there's one more segment that this year should also be decommissioned as well. What the bill is doing is basically nothing to do necessarily with the safety corridor program. We will continue the program. The key is the ability for those safety corridors that warrant it, to put the double fine provision in there in cooperation with law enforcement and the local courts so they are aware the signs are there and that option is there for law enforcement and the courts to use should they choose to use it. House Bill 2274 does remove the January 2008 sunset and allows us to continue the double fines and would look forward to your support of this very positive program. It's made a difference around the state. And, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that we had Troy's commitment from the Department of Transportation that by removing the sunset, and it's with some fear and trepidation that you just blanket remove sunsets, Troy. I want you to know that. But I just wanted to make sure that we had the Department of Transportation's absolute understanding and agreement that this does not foreclose or reduce their responsibilities to go back and make those necessary improvements to those corridors and the runway or roadways and the necessary improvements that are necessary to make them safer just by posting a double fine. It just seems a perverse long-term incentive if we're really not going to go in and make the adjustments that need to be made. Mm-hmm. Rather than saying, hey, this is a dangerous place to go, what can the Department of Revenue, or Department of Revenue, Department of Tax, which committee am I in? Transportation. Get the Department of Transportation to please, use their resources, and their number one mission statement is safety. to use those resources to make the transportation system safer.
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, thank you for adding more jobs. The Safety Corridor Program, and if you are interested, I did bring the guidelines of the program, which does require all four E's, as you actually heard this afternoon earlier in the Ways and Means Committee, with education, enforcement, engineering, and emergency medical services all working together there. It's a comprehensive, multi-partner program to work. Putting up just the rider on the sign that says double fines, that doesn't cut it, and that's not what we have in our established adopted guidelines for a department for a Safety Corridor Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other representatives?
Maybe I missed it. What's the definition of a safety corridor?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, safety corridor is a stretch of road on state highway system that has shown a history of greater death and or injury crashes based on the vehicles traveled in that corridor than other roads of its exact type. So we don't take Highway 101 and compare it with I-5 or compare it with other roads of each other, and that there needs to be a local commitment from business, from community members, from law enforcement and others to say, this is a stretch, it meets the data needs, now does it meet the local needs, and is everybody willing to pitch in? Because we're not going to put signs up if nobody's home. It doesn't make sense just to label a safety corridor if nobody's going to commit to doing education efforts by doing some things at local restaurants, placards on the tables, reminding them of things such as we did on ones leading to the coast, that law enforcement's willing to commit and be there at certain times that have proven to be difficulty, that the highway division has money set aside to do some low-cost safety improvements, rumble strips, centerline rumble strips, new signing, et cetera. If everybody's not willing to be at the table, then we're not going to put a sign up, because then I don't want to mislead the public that we're paying attention to this stretch of road. But it requires that commitment from all four parts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how many safety corridors do we have in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we have 13 corridors currently under signing, and a majority of those do have the double fines. We have not put the double fine provision on those corridors that are scheduled to be decommissioned. So I didn't want to put a double fine up for 4, 5, 6 months. We're ready to take the signs down, because again, I think that's not the intent of what this is about. It's meant to address the high impact areas.
One last quick question, Madam Chair. And so then the dollars generated from these fines go to the same location as a traditional fine would as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you are absolutely correct. They go the normal process, local fund, general fund.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. We have Mr. Koenig, who would like to come up and testify on this bill.
Thank you for your indulgence. This is kind of a quick one, but I heard a reference to the public has been getting the message that the department hopes to send, and I'm glad of that. I'm very gratified to see that we're having a decrease in injuries and fatalities on the Oregon highways. But I'm concerned about the construction there. It seemed to have an implication that we were talking about laws applicable to. And I want to remind the committee that we have constitutional provisions that describe the proper putting together of legislation under Article 4, section starting about Section 20, 21, 22, 27. 27 is an excellent section. It says, every statute shall be a public law unless otherwise declared in the statute itself. So on the first page of the motor vehicle laws, very first page, it says, this is applicable to 801, 020, subsection 4. This is applicable to the drivers of vehicles owned or operated by the United States, this state, every county, city, district, and other political subdivision of this state. And then a few pages over, still in the general provision section, it says at 801.050, it says, subject to compliance with the motor vehicle laws of the state, owners and operators of motor vehicles are granted the privilege to use the highway. Well, that's, you know, pretty clear. If we are remembering our Latin and we understand that operator is an employment term, that's pretty clear. But to clarify it a little bit further, the 1983 folks, legislature,
Oregon laws, Chapter 338, Section 51 of that year, 1983, they amended the definition of highway. So it's now every public way, road, street, thoroughfare, and place, including bridges, viaducts, and other structures within the boundaries of this state that are open, used, or intended for use by the public for vehicles, but not motor vehicles. Now, isn't that interesting? Not motor vehicles, but vehicles or vehicular traffic as a matter of right. So clearly, they are not the motor vehicle operators. It makes it clear. So I want that kind of perceptual problem that comes with speech, like we want to send a message to the public. I want to address that instead of let that innuendo go unaddressed. That's the only reason I came up for this little round. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Anybody else wanting to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2274, and I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2274.
Madam Chair, I move that we move to approve House Bill 2274 in committee for a vote on the floor of the House.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2274 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Those of the opinion that House Bill 2274 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye.
House Bill
2274 be placed on the consent calendar.
Thank you. Any objection? No.
Good.
So moved.
Good.
Okay. House Bill 2274 receiving the required votes is passed, and I'm going to close the work session. Thank you. Okay. We have one more, and that's 2276. And I open the public hearing on House Bill 2276.
Madam Chair, members, HB 2276 allows private schools to be reimbursed for courses in traffic safety education from the Student Driver Safety Fund. The measure would become effective July 1st, 2008. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Troy Castellis is up again.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Castellis, manager of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Thank
you. House Bill 2276 is our request through the governor in relationship to the public subsidy of driver education for teenagers across the state. Currently, public subsidy of a maximum of $210 per pupil is allowed to be reimbursed to driver education providers solely on the public sector side, meaning educational service districts, community colleges, or high schools. In the 1999 legislature, the driver education program was identified and shifted from the Department of Education to the Safety Division of ODOT. At the same time, that is when the graduated driver licensing program for teens took a second evolution and linked driver education with a teen getting their license. What has since happened is the attached two charts to my letter is that the number of 16-year-olds and number of 17-year-olds behind the wheel when someone is killed or injured has just absolutely dropped like a rock. It is amazing, way above anything we would have ever expected predicting in 99-2000 when the provisional license went in and when the beginning of standards around driver education and driver training were put in place. When that program came to my office in early 2000, one of the commitments that I made was when we get to a spot in time when the public sector and the private sector both are providing a quality educational class to teens, where the instructors have similar or the same training, where the curriculum they are using is achieving its effective goal of reducing death and injury, that it was my opinion that we needed to have a policy conversation with you about whether or not we now start to use the subsidy that goes to support the reduction of cost on the public side to also extend that to the private side. For me, from a programmatic point of sense, it doesn't matter to me where that teen goes and gets their class, as long as we have instructors that are doing the right thing and have a curriculum that's teaching the right thing. And the numbers over the last 5 years prove that we're making a difference across the state in reducing death and injury due to teenagers being behind the wheel. This is an option for the private sector. Private sector companies, one, can teach people how to drive and have nothing to do with the department training of teens. They can offer a class and do whatever they like, however they like, teaching whatever they like as a private company. However, if they want to teach teenagers to drive as part of their license, there's a set of requirements on the instructor and a set of requirements on the curriculum they teach, because that becomes part of what they go to DMV to get their license with. Secondly, what this is saying is that this is not requiring those public or those private companies that want to teach teens under the ODOT approved program that they have to ask for the subsidy. This is allowing that ability, so if that company so chooses, they can set a price and in turn get the public subsidy. The question that we had prior to session with legislative council was, how do you frame that? You have one of two ways, basically, the legislative council gave to me. One, you set a price cap, and anybody in the private sector that wants to go that route to get the subsidy, you have a price containment way of making sure that you're not using public funds to go over the top profit in a private business setting. Or two, you set a set administrative and profit margin that people then adhere to, and then now you let the local market drive what the actual price is, and you have a set margin of what's allowed to be considered profit. Very much similar to what Highway does with construction programs around the state. Same type of place. In this case, Legislative Council recommended to me that we use the set price piece, and so that's why that one particular set in the bill talks about the department through a rule setting a price cap. That was Legislative Council's recommendation, because we're estimating that this will probably be around 500 students that will go through private companies, that private companies would in turn ask for up to the $210 subsidy to help lower the cost. My hope from a program point of view is this helps get in some areas of the state that we do not have driver education currently. The public sector does not offer it. This might be something that somebody that wants to start a business might look at it and say, I've got a leg up because I've got some guaranteed revenue behind dealing with the car, dealing with getting somebody trained, insurance, and things like that, versus totally being out there on a limb at a risk and saying, I'm going to put a placard on the wall, I hope people sign up. In this case, if they're dealing with teens that are going through to get their driver license, they have somewhat of a guaranteed office and somewhat of a cushion to say the state in part is going to help them out, because it does make a difference in this state. Unfortunately, of the 35,000 sophomores in this state every year that go through our high school systems, only 11,000 or so are actually taking driver education, because it is not required in Oregon. Yet, when we look at what happens with kids involved with crashes that you see there, in a study comparing driver ed student drivers compared to those that don't take it, there's a dramatic reduction in crashes, convictions, and suspensions as well for those that take driver training compared to those that do not. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions as we deal with the philosophy of, do we open the student subsidy program to private providers around the state?
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Smith.
Representative
Tomei.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Troy. How do you know what the curriculum is in the private schools and that the standards, et cetera, that you referred to are met?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, in the current administrative rule, there is a list of criteria that the private sector needs to meet and show in the curriculum they are using, and they submit to my office for review and then information back to be certified. And there are times when there are pieces missing or something's not quite explained well enough that we can tell that that piece is being transferred to the teenager, and so we'll negotiate and possibly change some things in the curriculum. But they get a certification from our office. The administrative rules that are currently under debate ramps up the content of what needs to be in the curriculum, private and public, and also puts on the safety division a more rigorous standard of what we look at and certification piece, and there is a policy option package in the safety division budget in order to help out with that expected workload of what we would see with more businesses and a higher level of auditing requirement that we would do to make sure what they give us on paper is what they're delivering to the student.
Thank you, Troy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the father of a 15-year-old boy and as the driver of a Suburban with one less mirror on the side because a tree jumped out in the road, and mind you, the car didn't hit the tree jumped out in the road, I can attest to you the need for this type of program. I guess I have a question, and that is, this isn't taking away any opportunity from public sector providers. This is just providing an additional opportunity.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, correct.
Just a curiosity, are there what pockets of the state do not have service?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I'm going to see if I happen to have a... We have a document that ends up showing somewhat on a county-by-county basis how many providers are in that county and how many students are flowing through that program. I'd be more than happy to share that with you. And how many sophomores are in that county as well, so you can see the difference between number of students potential, number of schools teaching, and number of kids taking the class. And it's very evident. But even only at 11,000 out of 35, there's probably nowhere in the state that's going to show more than 33%.
Right. I think that'd be great to get that information. Maybe we could pass it around to everyone so they could see their own area.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't have the graph with me. I'm more than happy to bring it to Ms. Collins.
Okay. Representative Butler, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, I'm going to express to you a couple of items of concern that I have right up front on this. Now, you've already indicated that you're seeking a policy option package. I'm not sure what the amount of money there is in that POP,
right,
or where it's coming from, but I'm always anxious when we get any state agency that wants the language on number 9 on this bill, which must be certified by the department, making the department the ultimate judge of the course. What happens is we always see that cost then being passed on to taxpayers one way or another. When private industry, I mean, we've got education and out-of-state and in-state education providers for this kind of an activity, and that's a concern that I have when they become the sole judge and jury as to who gets certified or what the curriculum is to be certified, and that also says that only Oregon knows. You cannot bring out-of-state resource and knowledge as to which programs will be the best programs. Now, I don't doubt that they have today, in 2007, the very best of intentions as to what kinds of programs would be implemented in the state of Oregon under their sole direction and certification. But that's always an issue. And then the second issue I have is down on lines 19, 20, and 21, where the department then determines the maximum amount which will be charged by any of the private schools. I really look at that and I say, you know what? I don't know that I trust the Department of Transportation to be setting my educational fees in the state of Oregon. I mean, there's 90 of us that have a tough time doing that every 2 years. So those are two concerns that I would just express about this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. Troy, do you have any sense of how the costs at private providers compare with the costs in the public sector?
Madam Chair and Representative Reed, I do not. The only cost issues that I have access to is when private companies become the public, let's say high school, just as an example, public high school chooses not to run the program themselves, and so they contract. I see that information because it's part of, on the public sector, when a high school, just use that as an example, charges you as the parent, they have to show me what they took in tuition and what it cost them, and then I make up the difference. Public schools are not allowed to make a profit. So that's the only way, by indirect link, I can see what private schools are charging because they're under contract. What they charge on their own, what their fees are, and they are not required to report to me, so I can't tell that other than surmising based on what they do under public contract.
Follow.
Yes.
And in that case, would you characterize those as roughly equal, or is there a dramatic difference?
Representative Reed, I can't even venture a guess. What I'm looking at with this program is the fact that there's a statutory cap of $210. And the difficulty, as Representative Butler was talking about, is how do you look at what private can charge and then in turn have public subsidy, making sure that we're trying to lower the cost so there's more access for kids to take it because we've proven that it works. And I brought you one option. There may be other options that you might be able to debate and discuss.
One last question. Yes. Can you tell me why did you choose to make it effective July 1st, 2008? Why not sooner?
Madam Chair and Representative Reed, July 1 to July 1 is the cycle that we currently have, and it was actually what Department of Education started, and it fits the fiscal cycle of the predominant vendor, which is the public schools.
Okay.
So that cycle is what we've built all our administration around. I would not want to start a separate second cycle, because then administratively I've just taken on a cost. I would rather be more efficient and have the same cycle going on at the same time of reporting, and I'm not adding administrative cost to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, on the point brought up by Representative Butler, in terms of the course that will be certified by the department, is there any obstacle to the department considering the best curriculum from any source, from any state, from any private source as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, in thinking along those exact lines, when we took over the program in 1999-2000, I personally went around to public hearings around the state, engaging as many people as I could in the conversation, actually prior to even getting an FTE to run the program. I did it as the administrator. We have a 5-member governor-appointed traffic safety committee that in statute says to run this program, we must use them as our advisors. So we're running a citizen body, just different than the commission. It's the Transportation Safety Committee. In turn, the safety OTSC, the safety committee, indicated we're not experts, and we don't necessarily have kids. My son's 16, so he just went through it himself. I still have my side mirror, though.
You just wait.
The bar.
But that they created a driver education advisory committee made up of community college, private commercial schools, and high school membership to guide this program. And so any of the curriculum standards, any of the instructor standards are aired and vetted and debated amongst the group that this impacts, then to the 5-member Oregon Transportation Safety Committee for us to look at putting into rule. Where did the first list come from in 2000? The things that we knew kids were getting in trouble over. That was it. I mean, because we had nothing to go by in this state. There were no curriculum standards. Where are we today with the rule that we're proposing to put in place is exactly, Representative Buckley, as you're talking about, and Representative Butler and others have talked about, it is looking at the national curriculum that's been established by a nationwide group and understanding what is in our best interest, because this is what teens are getting tickets for. This is what their errors are as drivers in relationship to crashes, and enhancing those things so that we can continue to see the decline that you've seen in the handout, because this is what I want. And this is in all of our best interest from a whole bunch of reasons. This is what we want to see this number keep going down. So we will continue to monitor and have that driver advisory committee engaged in what do we need to make sure we do for Oregon. Is there need to be a tweak? Because situations have changed. The type of vehicles they're driving have changed. We've emphasized, for instance, work zones this last year or so because there are so many more work zones. Generally speaking, in a national curriculum, they're not going to talk about work zones.
Right.
Nor are they going to talk about snow and ice necessarily, because most of the country doesn't experience snow and ice. So, Representative Buckley, it's not something we necessarily just grab out of the air. We try and do put some effort into making sure we're doing the best and the right thing in the curriculum standards.
Appreciate it. One more?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the Section 4, the provision that would allow for the cap, can you just explain a little bit more? Do I have this correct, that the intent is to ensure access for as many students as possible and not have finances stand in the way of Representative Smith's son finally getting legal? Would you please just confirm for me that that's the intent of it? And if I can just add on, are you open to other proposals that would address that concern of having access?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, you're correct. The issue here is to provide access and not have financial hardship be in the way of having teenagers take driver education around the state. So we have a dedicated fund for this program and have a sound fund related to the program, which some of you on the committee will see in the Ways and Means process as well, as this bill would too. I guess it's got the sub-referral to Ways and Means. The fund is there to help out in those situations that if the private company chooses to accept and want to take the public subsidy. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Representative Butler introduced a thought that I should have asked, but I forgot. The pop on this, how are we going to pay for this?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, there currently is, for every new driver license or renewed driver license, there's a small set of money that's put in a student driver training fund.
Okay.
For the purpose of driver education.
Okay.
That fund is solvent. The policy option package we have put forward, this bill that we have put forward, when matched and looked at the fund is solvent for as far as I want to forecast, which is 6 to 8 years.
Okay. Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to share with you, Madam Chair, down in Ways and Means, they don't have an opportunity to air these type of bills the way they do here, and so I'm kind of enjoying this to be able to ask questions. Question for you. I'm an entrepreneur, small business owner in Eastern Oregon. I want to become a driving instructor. How do I do it?
Madam Chair,
under this program.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, should be on this side of the microphone about asking questions. First and foremost, any private company that wants to teach behind-the-wheel driver training on the road must register as a business and take a set of tests and show insurance coverage through DMV, first and foremost. That doesn't matter what age they're teaching. If they're doing behind-the-wheel on road, they've got to register and be business through DMV. From those 28 to 30 companies, if you so choose an entrepreneur you want to deal with and teach teens as part of their way to get a driver's license, then you would come to us and say, we will meet your instructor training standards and your curriculum standards to then offer this course. Your choice, it's not required. If you choose, we have an agreement with Western Oregon University and individual instructors that have become master trainers that can offer the training you would need to show that you have got the training to be able to deliver the class to the teens. At the same time, we provide workshops on curriculum development that we use some of the ODOT facilities on the weekend to allow people to come in and develop their curriculum that meet or exceed the current standards. So there's a lot of help. We subsidize your training. We subsidize your curriculum development as best as we can under, actually what I'm doing is flexing federal funds, highway safety funds, to cover the private sector, because I can't, without this change, I can't use the state-borne driver license fee to help the private firms out. I'm doing that with flexible federal highway safety funds instead. So there's a lot of things that help you. It is not easy. I will not say to you that you can just walk in and then 8 a.m. tomorrow put a shingle on the door and up and run. There's things, because you are now an agent of the state to help that teen get their license. I want to make sure that you're doing the right thing and doing it the right way.
But follow up, Madam Chair. But the process is not going to be so bureaucratic that it's going to discourage a sole proprietor from trying to start this, would it?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, there will be some on both sides of that answer. Some will say it is, and some will say it isn't. And it just depends on the individual side of what they want to do as to whether or not they want to invest the time in the instructor training as themselves or their employees, and if they want to invest the time into meeting or exceeding the curriculum standards. If they think this is something that's a quick buck, that's not what this is here for.
Like, just one last observation. Okay. I could see just where if you had an instructor in a larger community, say Bend or Klamath Falls or LeGrand, those are large communities where I come from. If you had a student base of 20 students per month, you could have yourself a nice little business. Just an observation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Okay. Sandra Bishop and George Doddington can come up together.
Take a seat. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. We'd tell you a little longer story in relation to Representative Smith's question, but that's for another time. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to ask a question again. My name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here as the government relations person for the Driving School Association of Oregon. These are the professional commercial driving schools, and they provide training, driver's ed, for people of all ages and in all situations, but they also are, a lot of them have tried to be, and a lot of them are certified under the license of the DMV in providing the approved curriculum from TSD for teen drivers. And so George Doddington is here with me today also to answer the real questions about how the program really works. So just briefly, we believe that there is an error in House Bill 2276, and I passed out this rather sort of generic-looking amendment trying to make it easy for you to pass it on to Ledge Council. We believe, and I think Troy stated it, that the intention of House Bill 2276 was to get equity between the public providers and the private providers of driver's education to teens. And I think what happened is Ledge Council incorporated the term private school, but they didn't necessarily refer back to the definition in the ORS. And so what we're proposing, the first half of this page is literally saying you need to insert the words commercial driver training school in order for it to be able to have reimbursement cover the schools. And then the second thing we're asking for, we're requesting that you address the question that Representative Butler brought up, and that is lines 19, 20, and 21. We're requesting that section 4 be deleted. This is where the department is asking to set by rule the maximum amount per pupil that a private business can charge for the training for the teen. And this is problematic for two reasons. Number one, it seems unreasonable and perhaps unprecedented to have the Department of the State actually dictating, mandating to a business what they can charge for a service. It's a private business and it's usually market driven. And so there may be a way to work around that. There may be a way to say that they can't charge more than the reimbursement. I don't know quite how to work with that one, but there does seem to be something awry there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this is a question for Judith. If the Department of Transportation introduced a fee, they set the fee, they're still going to have to come back to the legislature at the next convening to get our concurrence. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, to Representative Smith's response, or to respond to his question, I think there's a Senate bill that we follow, that is that we come back in and in the regular session and basically carte blanche approve, unless we've had a very significant negative response from our constituents and other folks, and the program has suffered some pretty hefty downturn. But yes, we do in effect, in the Ways and Means process,
correct,
ratify the fees that an agency has imposed in the interim.
So I just share that there is a check and balance on that.
Thank you for clarifying that. The second issue with this,
can I stop you just a second, because I think we kind of interrupted you in a thought that I was, that's okay, was curious about when you were saying that instead maybe they should think about setting a cap, or what were you saying?
Well, I think that what the, Chair, Byron, members of the committee, I think what the intent here is so that you don't have some sort of price gouging and so that you try to keep teen drivers at affordable. That's one thing, but it gets a little dicey when you're putting an actual mandate on a private business saying you know, we have to charge this amount. It may be too much for the market. I mean, it may be in a rural area where the kids can't afford it, and it's going to simply price them out of driver's ed, and that's already happening.
Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you,
Madam Chair. Just so that I can understand where you're going with this, if the subsidy from the state is $210, a private company does not have to accept that subsidy. They can instead train people who are not subsidized. So I'm struggling with this guy. I'm not sure how this is different than when we subsidize a doctor's visit under the Oregon Health Plan. We basically say you cannot charge more than X number of dollars because the intent of that is to make sure that that citizen has access to health care. And this would seem to be the same principle. We're trying to get access to traffic, to driver training for the citizens, for the teenage citizens of our state. So I'm not quite sure where the dilemma is in terms of the department able to say, look, if we're going to subsidize 210, you can't charge 700, because that will go against what our intent is of providing access.
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley. Yes, I understand. I follow your logic. Let me finish the second concern about this, and maybe you'll see why we have a concern about it. The second concern is that we don't believe there's any way for the department to calculate this maximum amount because they have a pool of money. And the way the law is written, it says that they will offer $210 per student as reimbursement. That's in Section 2. Then Section 3 says, but by the way, we will prorate it if we have more students. So there's sometimes the reimbursement has been quite insignificant when it's gone to the public schools. So we're just trying to figure out logistically how could this possibly work. So you're basically asking a private company to set a price for a service before they know what they're going to be reimbursed. So it's just a little difficult. But there may be some way to work with it, but it's a little problematic at this point. But I really appreciate your analogy to the healthcare because it is about access. So if there's a way that we can work with the department and come out with something that looks equitable, then perhaps we wouldn't have to eliminate it entirely. Maybe we can define it a little more clearly. And then the other request is that we would like to change the effective date, and we heard loud and clear what Troy Gonzalez said, and we'd like to change that to July 1, 2007. We see no reason to wait an additional year with this money basically sitting in a pot, and young people who are now eligible for driver's ed will not be eligible for driver's ed if you wait a year because there's a very short window of time because of their age where they're eligible for these programs. So we would really appreciate getting this into play in the next cycle rather than waiting for an additional year. And that would still be in sync with administrative rules that are being rewritten now, and they'll be adopted well before July 1st, or we expect them to be. So thank you. Any questions? And George has a couple of remarks,
Carolyn,
to make, too.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sandra, I'm concerned about commercial driving, driver training school. I mean, are you talking about people who will be commercial drivers?
Chair Beyer. Vice Chair Tomei, the definition under ORS 336.790, subsection 1, is, quote, commercial driver training school means a school operated by a person issued a commercial driver training school certificate by the Department of Transportation under, and then they list the ORS. This is what Troy was answering in relation to Representative Smith's answer, how do you become a driving school? And these are the commercial driving schools.
Follow up?
Yes.
I just want to clarify. So you are not training people to be commercial drivers. That's my question. Okay. Thank you.
Correct. Thank you. Okay, George.
Well, excuse me.
Yeah. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Tomei. Yes, it is possible that, but the commercial in this context is that we're a commercial business. We do, these folks do train commercial. They also may train state employees. They may train your grandmother. They may train someone from another country, or they may train teens. So it does include training for commercial driver's licenses, but that's not the exclusive use of the term commercial in this definition. This is a professional driving school, a private business. Thank you.
I can understand that. Representative Butler just said to me, for-profit, I guess I would be more comfortable if it said it's clear to us what you're saying, but it sounds like you're training people to be commercial drivers, you're training these kids to be truck drivers, but that's not your intent.
I don't want his son driving trucks.
Trust me,
representative. It's not good.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm George Doddington, president of Driving School Association of Oregon. We wholeheartedly approve of this bill. It's a really positive step to make more availability to the kids in the state. Our only concern is the formula as far as how they're going to determine what a maximum amount of tuition would be when they have floating revenues that could change and have historically in the past dropped below their maximum allowable amount. So with the number that Troy came up with, as far as he hinted, you know, around $500 would be totally acceptable under the current conditions. If that, you know, if the enrollment levels increase in the state, there could be more application for reimbursement. You know, those applications would rise and you know, put more of a taxation on the pool itself. So it could diminish to the point where there was, you know, if we increase the number of students, then it could increase the amount of reimbursement going out, decrease the amount of the pool level. So if we go below the 210 amount, then we may be forced to go to higher tuition rates. And it's a speculation as far as, you know, just how much reimbursement, how many students are going to go through the program, and how much funds are actually going to be there to allocate for that amount of kids. So I would be a lot more comfortable if there was an established formula that they could follow to, you know, to make sure that they don't lower the maximum level to a point where we could end up losing if, you know, 14 months from the beginning of this period before we get reimbursement back, you know, that you apply after the reimbursement year is when you send in an application for reimbursement, and then there's another couple of months before that fund is distributed. So it's kind of a lot of the public schools right now have to be careful as far as where they set their tuition rates, and you know that some of them are hedging as far as really being careful because there might not be that whole 210 there, and they absolutely cannot afford to create an expense with this program because they're so strapped for funds already.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Byron. I guess I need some help here. You're already in competition with the public sector. And there's public driving programs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're already in competition. There's no obligation, I assume, for you to enter into this program. And so even if the state says we'll give you $10 reimbursement for every student, I don't know what you're out. What am I missing here? It's not as if there's already competition out there. The state of Oregon is saying through this program we're going to provide a reimbursement rate. If you choose not to accept the rate the state offers, you can say we don't want it. We don't want to be part of that, and you can continue to operate your for-profit school the way you currently are operating it. What am I missing on that?
Well, it could be a trap as far as you know, if we're assuming that we're going to get the 210 back and then until we set our tuition accordingly, and then
okay.
All of a sudden, there's the, you know, after the year's gone by, all of the applications have been submitted.
Yep.
They determine how much is there, and then we've got to prorate that, and then so it changes as far as what comes back. And if for some reason that maximum level has dropped below, you know, where our cost is, then we're going to lose.
I understand. Follow up. Sure. I understand that, but I would assume before you entered into this, you're going to have some type of agreement with the Department of Transportation. They're going to have a rate schedule in which you're going to be able to concur with or not concur with.
Well, that I would like to see.
Is that not the case?
That's kind of the point right now.
Or do you just submit a handful of invoices of students.
Well, we have to account for students that have gone through the qualified program at year end, and then that's all amassed, and then it's determined, you know, whether there's funds enough or if needs to be prorated. You know, currently and for the next 5 or 6, 7 years, there's a subsubsidy there, a big pool.
Just one last follow-up, if I may, Chair Beyer. So what you're saying is you want some predictability in this, not the assumption you're going to enter into this program, have students signed up at a certain rate, and 12 months later find out that your reimbursement rate is half of what you anticipated it being.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I'd like to know how the formula is, because really it's kind of speculation as to how much money there's going to
sure.
be there. You know,
and then
how many
that's
kids
a fair
go
concern.
Through it. How many kids go through it. And right now, you know, especially, you know, if that number were at 500, that's comfortable. I mean, that's not a problem at all. I mean, right now, tuition rates at, you know, going at public school level, which I contract with public schools to provide the program, so I'm really aware of where they're at with it, and it runs from $200 to $300 pretty regularly, you know.
Representative Chair Beyer, may I respond to Representative Smith's question? Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, your earlier question, the real answer here is this is actually about equity. It's about allowing the reimbursement to go to the private providers as well as the public providers. That's why they're including the private schools as well as the businesses that provide driver ed. So that's more to the point, trying to get that equity in. It's because you're right about it's a private business, so you're not required to provide the service. But there are areas of the state where there's no driver's ed available, and the public schools are so severely strapped that some of the public programs are actually shutting down. And it would be really valuable if you could make it equitable so that in some of those areas, especially some of the small rural areas, that someone that's running an actual business with driver's ed who can meet the criteria of the DMV and the Transportation Safety Division can come in and provide driver's ed for teens. Otherwise, there is no driver's ed.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. George Doddington, in this bill it says that you will be paid $210 per pupil. And Mr. Costales said that the program is solvent for, I think, 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make you comfortable knowing that at least, say, for the next 5 or 6 years, this program would be solvent and you would be getting this $210 per pupil? That's not the case.
No.
Actually, for the next few years, I'm comfortable with
it. I'm going to interrupt just a second.
Excuse me.
We need to kind of start going back to the courtesy of addressing the members of the committee. Thank you.
Representative Beyer, Vice Chair Tomei?
Tomei.
Now I've lost here.
Sorry.
I'm comfortable with where we're at, although we really want to encourage more kids. I mean, we want more kids. We're only reaching, you know, I'd say it's more like a quarter, not a third, of the available and eligible teens that are out there. And we need to promote this, and that's being addressed in the advisory committees, you know, that we really want to promote this, get it out to the parents, and make this a worthy program that parents are gonna see the value in and really want to get their kids into, and that's been missing for a long time, and now that we've got the quality standards up, everybody's on the same page, it's, you know, that's where this is all leading to, is to promote more kids. Well, the more kids we get, then that is going to impact the level of funds in the program. I mean, if you look at it right now and say, well, yeah, it's solvent, it's gonna last, you know, at the current rate of only, you know, 10,000-11,000 kids going through it a year, that's fine. But if that number goes up to 20,000, then things could tip. You know, that there is a volatility there to that program that I'm concerned about. for the next few years, I think it's fine. I'm comfortable with that 210 number. Although we do encourage school districts that we contract with to communicate with the department to assure them that they are going to get that full reimbursement factor, you know, so they can decide and determine their tuition rate comfortably.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Starting, so what I'm hearing, though, is that you would be willing to work with the Department of Transportation to develop a formula that would do something along the lines of guaranteeing a minimum, if they could also be discussing with you what the maximum would be in order to address the issue of access.
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, correct. I would think that if there could be some sort of formula with some cushions in there, or whatever, to adjust accordingly, so that there isn't a situation created where a provider could lose money, you know, because they've been held under a cap is really, that's my main concern. And I don't foresee that happening right now in the near future because of the solvency of the pool itself.
No more questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I make one more comment? Chair Beyer and committee, about the timeline as far as the accounting year, as far as the way that reimbursement works, the school districts send in their eligible students at year end, and then that's all worked with. The deadline is the last day in July. For reimbursement applications for the prior year. So I'm not really understanding why there'd be any accounting problem. Some schools don't even have a program until the spring term, and then they go through that and then send in their eligibility, in July. Others may only have a winter term or the actual program's going on throughout the year, and I'm not seeing where there has to be a start at a certain date, of the accounting year so much, because it's the reimbursement's done, from the prior year throughout the year. So it seems to me that it could start at virtually any time. My recommendation would be, because of the new administrative rules going into effect in September, that's when we're assured that everybody's on the same page and we've got viable programs coming from the private and public sector that would conform to the new requirements. So I don't see where there's a big problem with why it has to start on the accounting year so much.
Just Chair Beyer, I have thoughts on why the Department of Transportation would do that, but to share them right now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, fine. Be that.
There's a public hearing process. They're setting up budgets. I mean, they may not even get at it. Well, we will be out of here June 30th. But, I mean, it's going to take the department time.
We have Ben Pillo. I get it right.
I didn't mean to call you too fire.
No, that's fine.
Sorry. And please forgive me, I'm pretty new at this, so as far as the courtesies and things like that, if I slip a step on, forgive me. What we have here
is... You want to please restate your name.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize. My name is Benjamin Philo. And I'm with a group called the Committee for Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Laws. We're a collection of regular citizens who have come to understand some things about our laws pertaining to motor vehicle laws. And what we have in front of us as far as our task is a mountain of conditioning that has persuaded us as a society to believe that licenses apply to the public. Let me read the definition of license out of our laws at chapter 183, and it's 183.310 sub 5.
Apparently it's not coming up here. Okay. 183.310, subsection 5, this quote, license, includes the whole or part of any agency permit, certificate, approval, registration, or similar form of permission required by law to pursue any commercial activity, trade, occupation, or profession. This is the verbatim language of our laws. And we go to motor vehicle laws, Title 59. I've got all these things up here on my screen. We'll go to the definition of driver license at 801.245. Driver license or license may have any or all of the meanings provided for the terms under this section as required or appropriate under the section referring to the term. The term driver license, quote, quote, may be used interchangeably with license, quote, quote. And it goes on from there. And since the Constitution requires that any given law pertain only to one subject, it's Article 4, Section 20, I believe, of the Oregon Constitution, requires that any given law can only pertain to one subject matter, one subject class of people being affected. And under 803.031, or 807, I should say, 031, the classes of licenses. Specifically, Class A commercial driver license, Class B commercial driver license, Class C commercial driver license, and then they have another one in there that's called Class C just by itself. Well, since you can't mingle laws regulating commercial activity with laws that affect the general public, especially when it's required that by the Constitution that laws, all statutes are to be considered public laws unless otherwise expressed in the statute itself. This statute is expressing very clearly that it's of a commercial nature. This is something that is so ingrained into us as our culture is used to it for decades of this being the case. That it's something that we have to get over. These folks that have been speaking here prior to me have been discussing ways to further integrate into our psyches this notion that we have to have licenses to use the highways, when in fact it says 801.305 under Title 59, the Motor Vehicle Code, again, find it here, highway, means every place, every public way, road, street, thoroughfare, and place, including buildings, viaducts, and other structures within the boundaries of this state, open, used, or intended for use of the general public for vehicles or vehicular traffic as a matter of right. Under Chapter 174, Legislative Construction, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm trying to figure out the relevancy of this conversation to driver education training in the bill before us.
Well, and I was trying to determine that too, so would you kind of let us know, in a short order, because our meeting is almost over.
Well, what I'm getting at here is these educational programs that have been brought before you, and we've discussed them to some extent, they're based on providing our kids education so that they can get a license. It's training our kids to become indoctrinated into believing that they have to have a license, like we have been, when in fact, in law, it's not supported, never has been.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Maybe you can make my point.
Has your association ever attempted to file a court case to prove the validity of your interpretation?
Yes, sir.
And can you tell me the result of that court case, or?
My experiences in court, sir, my first experience, for example, I subpoenaed Mr. Fanning behind me to be my expert witness material to the application of the statutes, the subject matter jurisdiction of the statutes to the public. I subpoenaed him to be my expert witness on those points in a pre-trial phase of the trial called a hearing on demurrer. Subpoena in hand, he was physically restrained from entering the building
the courthouse. He was not allowed to enter the building to be at my trial. In the course of my trial, the statute 153.083 specifically requires an officer, if challenged on the jurisdiction of the laws that he's applying, he is specifically required to argue the application of the statutes, their jurisdictional application, their relevance to the ticket.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry to ask. I was just trying to get a short answer, and you have taken this to court. So the only thing I could say is that going to an attorney or working with an attorney might be to your benefit at this time, because I'm not sure this committee is going to be able to satisfy the interpretation.
No, I understand. I apologize. I'm just trying to give you the benefit of my experiences.
Thank you.
I thought that's what you were...
Thank you. And I think maybe we got the message that you say we don't need a license to drive, and they're pushing this. So thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2276. And I'm going to adjourn the committee. And thank you, everybody, for staying.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Enjoyed.